and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, March 8th, 2024. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble's Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow, Madison Edward Wright, sits down with Sarah Jama, independent MPP for Hamilton Centre. The two discuss Jama's removal from the NDP caucus due to her quote-unquote early calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, and how Jama's activism influences her politics. Here are Madison Edward Wright and Sarah Jama in conversation. Take a listen.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Madison Edward Wright, and today I'm sitting down with Sarah Jama, the independent member of the Ontario Parliament for Hamilton Centre. MPP Jama was elected last March and has since used her time in office to continuously fight for the interests of her constituents, among many other things. Thank you so much for joining me today, Ms. Jama.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be chatting with you again. I feel like at every phase of my life, whether it's as an activist or organizer or now elected, I always somehow find myself on a Rabble podcast. So I think the last time I was on was with DJ and O.
Yeah. And I mean, we always love having you too. I think you have such an important message to share. You do such amazing work. So for us, it's always a pleasure as well to be able to welcome you to the show and to Rabble. You know, I understand that Queen's Park, Ontario's Legislative Assembly, is just recently back in session, and that this is your first full session starting as an independent. How has it been since returning to the Assembly, you know, with your new agenda? How have things gone for you so far?
I think it's going pretty well. This is my second week sitting as an independent member with Queen's Park back in session. I think it's going well so far. My team and I have worked very hard over the last 3 months since I became an independent to really reconnect with constituents on the ground here in Hamilton, to hear on the doors what key issues folks wanted me to take forward. Because I'm not operating with a party platform anymore. I wanted to make sure that the issues that I'm bringing forward are rooted in what residents here and constituents want me to focus on. So out of those conversations, door knocking with the Independent Riding Association, and also through taking a really serious look at casework that's coming into the office, we've been able to identify the areas that folks wanted us to really hone in on. And that would be housing, healthcare, the environment, and social assistance. Hamilton, Ontario, particularly Hamilton Centre, is the poorest riding in the entire province. So it's a very working class city. And so we just really want to make sure that what we put forward in our office is really reflecting back what everyone wants to see. In that way, it's been really liberating to be able to be rooted by what folks are telling us to talk about versus having things scripted by a top-down apparatus. So that's been awesome. In terms of understanding the logistical implications of what being centered and also being an independent means, I'm still mostly figuring it out. But what I do know is that even though I can't debate, I can still participate in voting. I can still participate fully in committee and participate in discussions in committee as well. I can't ask a question in question period, but the debates don't really matter too much since the majority conservative government tends to only listen to themselves either way. And the most important thing that I've learned is that I can still table motions and put forward good ideas.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. And something I've noticed just in seeing you speak in the assembly before the censure, but also, you know, whether it's videos you're putting out for your constituents, is that you really are grounded in what your voters want to see and how they want to see you represent their interests. And I think what's been really refreshing to see in politics is that you're not afraid to say what needs to be said. You know, whether that's calling for a ceasefire or advocating for disability justice in Canada, And you really haven't let the censoring thing slow you down, I think. And so how much of your previous experience in activism do you think prepared you for where you are now and the position you're in, you know, working in government?
I think my framework of how I operate, how I think, has been really shaped by organizing in community spaces. For example, the first two motions I've tabled last week were on what I talked a little bit about earlier, social assistance and housing reform, particularly around tying the housing benefit portion of ODSP to the average market rent in the city that you live in. Because even if you double it or increase the amount arbitrarily, it still has to tie into what the rent is in your area. But that idea actually came from the ODSP Action Coalition, who wrote the motion with me. So it's never been in my nature to just operate as an individual. I'm deeply uncomfortable with that. And I see my position as an elected as a conduit between the everyday people that I represent in this political apparatus, as a tool. I don't see myself as the system. I see my position as a tool. And so I'm able to like reach out to ODSP Action Coalition and say, what would you like to see changed? I've identified this as a key issue. And rather than me being like, oh, I'm the politician who's elected, who has all the great ideas, I understand very deeply that I was elected and put here to be that conduit and representative of community. So the activity of like writing the motion with them, even in tabling it, being very clear that they wrote it, and at the press conference, letting them lead it and organize it, I think this way of thinking versus seeing everything as a political moment to clip and then post so that I can show that I'm specifically doing my individual job and I'm a good politician, I'm very, very comfortable with the idea that my job is to facilitate access, one, and two, very comfortable with the understanding that I don't know everything, so I know who to ask. I think politicians who don't come from organizing roots struggle with those two things, the decentralizing of power, but also being very comfortable to not have this giant ego where it's difficult to say, look, I don't know all of the issues that or solutions that should come forward. Let me find the right people to talk about this with. And so I think those two understandings come very, very, very much from my organizing history and just knowing who I'm accountable to and for what reasons. And you can see that in my, for the most part, consistent views on Palestine, for example, before the election, during the election, when the issue of Palestine and the genocide was coming up in different ways, and then also when the October 7th happened. My analysis on the issue has been very consistent, and it's mainly just been a battle of trying to bring everyone else around me at that time on board.
Yeah, I can't imagine what that was like for you to deal with and kind of wrap your head around afterwards.
The whole thing was a lot, and I think what was even more strange was the censure debate. The government wasted 8 hours of time debating whether or not my statement was in support of terrorism, however that's defined in that specific context, and the premier saying that I supported the beheading and assault of Israeli women. Like, just completely random and devoid of any actual truth. So the whole thing kind of felt wild, and I think the worst part is the amount of space that those conversations took away from the actual conflict. Like, that I was beating myself up the entire time about how much airtime this whole thing took, because folks were using that as a scapegoat conversation rather than talking about what was going on.
Do you think maybe the government's hesitation, across all parties to recognize and stand up for Palestine comes more from this understanding of politics as a top-down versus yourself, I think, coming from your activism roots, really with a more bottom-up approach where you're really consulting your constituents and community organizations to make sure that policy reflects them versus theorizing about policy and then hoping that it reflects what people want?
I think the political class across the board have a hard time understanding where people are at. Like, if you look at the voter turnout in our communities, only 30% of folks actually turned up into the polls to vote. Everybody else is checked out or just have this feeling of hopelessness that no matter who you elect, the government's not going to change anything. And I think that does come from the structures that we operate in. Most people who are elected have been elected for decades. Most people who are elected are men, come from like upper middle class backgrounds or super wealthy the Legislative Assembly is not representative of everyday people, working class people. I don't know if it will ever be. I don't know if these systems will ever be a reflection of what people actually need or deserve in terms of leadership. It's broken. So even to become elected and try to talk about current issues that people actually care about, you could see even in the central process, there's a huge disconnect. I don't think the system itself on a provincial level will fix everything, but I do think it's a good place for harm reduction work, or to at least expose the flaws that exist in the system and where the holes are, and to sort of be one of the many voices out there trying to move political consciousness along, if I can't at least get good motions passed, which is borderline impossible under a majority government. Not impossible. So yeah, I do think the system was created broken and will stay broken. And I think in my statement around the ceasefire, calling into question settler colonialism was in part to, I thought, to try to mitigate the sort of like heavy response from the political class that was going to come. Because calling Israel an apartheid state, even through quoting the United Nations, was going to be controversial, right? And so it was a call in to the political class. And even then, it wasn't seen that way.
You know, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about how you've come out of the gate with your status as an independent member, and how you've continued to advocate for Palestine in the legislature. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So in terms of a local outcome of what happened, we have an independent Rhino Association that's registered. We have about 60 active members already. We've quietly raised about $35,000 without much of a fundraising push. Folks are really happy to see representation that's not just about partisanship by any means necessary, but more about sending people there who you have faith that are going to represent you. And if they don't have all the answers, they're going to literally go out and ask what the right thing to say and do is. So we have an independent writing association. We've been going out on the doors, talking to folks in different neighborhoods to get a sense of where they're at, what key issues are. And on the doors, folks have either said, we support you 100%, or we don't know if it's your place to weigh on international politics, but we also don't agree with the censure because we have a right to be represented at Queen's Park and your voice has been taken away. So across the board, on a local level, there's been a lot of support, and I'm excited to see what's possible in running as an independent again in 2026 or just being an independent. The Writing Association has legal rules that they need to follow in terms of structure, but outside of those confines which they are following, they're creating their own ways of functioning. Traditionally, writing associations tend to be pretty small, heavily filled with staffers, but folks have created their own outreach committees and their own terms of reference committee and figuring out how they want to operate amongst themselves. And it's been really great to see. They're creating like neighborhood captains. It's been awesome to just like support, but also stand back and say, okay, what does Hamilton Center want to see for Hamilton Center? It's been a really awesome experiment.
So I've also been kind of paying attention to community organizations, not just in Ontario, but really across Canada. And there's been some really widespread support for you, I think, coming out of the censure, but also just your general message about a ceasefire in Palestine, justice for Palestinians. And so I was wondering, you know, what that support has meant for you in terms of, you know, motivation versus the government who's kind of beating down on you.
I think it's meant a lot. Again, I think since October, I've been grappling with the amount of, like, because I'm elected, the media, instead of centering Palestinian voices, has, like, over and over again scapegoated me in these conversations. I talked about this, like, even during the campaign, too. It's jarring when there are people in my riding who have family under the rubble, like, and I get those emails and I read it to the media and trying to pivot to say, hey, like, talk about the actual conflict. That's been frustrating, but I also know that being able to speak about repression on this level in a way supports a lot of the folks, especially Palestinians who are facing repression in their workplaces. A lot of folks are losing their jobs or being punished. So on a different scale, I feel like it has been very humbling to sort of push back in the ways that I can too. I'm still like the rest of everybody, in Ontario and across this country and everywhere else, scrolling online every night, like having a hard time going to sleep because I'm trying to get updates or just watching these horrible, horrible videos, just thinking like, is there anything more that I could be doing? Like a statement is nothing. And what I wrote was very basic, very basic, very watered down, very basic, and not even had like a quarter of what could and should have been said even at that time. So there's a lot of like internal conflict that I still work through as an elected in terms of like, am I doing all that I can or am I saying all of the right things? I'm fighting the censure in court. So we had our judicial review quite recently and that has been hopeful too. I don't have a verdict yet at the time this is being recorded, but so far it's already been a precedent setting case in the sense that the legal fight to fight for a judicial review, that's where we're at right now. The government is saying there shouldn't be a judicial review at all. So we're fighting that in court. And the judge allowed me to have three interveners involved, the Center for Civil Liberties Association, but also a second team of interveners made up of the Independent Jewish Voices Canada, the Jewish Faculty Network of Canada, and the Arab Lawyers Association of Canada. Those three groups, the government argued they don't have constitutional expertise and tried to get them thrown out as interveners. But the judge ruled that they should be able to intervene, which already shows that context is important even in this conversation around the judicial review, and allows those three organizations, it sets a precedent that they can be interveners across the country for a bunch of other legal cases because they've never done it before. So even if, I don't know if we'll be successful or not, but even then I think continuing to take on that fight, even though the legal system is also broken, is sort of paving the way for others to keep fighting in the ways that we can too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something that's also kind of entered the public narrative with so many different movements coming together in support of Palestine and voicing their support, is this understanding that whether this is happening in Palestine, this colonialism in Palestine, settler colonialism in Canada that continues, and the widespread oppression, and really the fact that we're fighting the same systems of oppression. Like geography doesn't play as big of a role as we think. Like the continued colonial project of Israel in Palestine and the allowing that to continue, not standing up for the rights of Palestinians and how that also translates to the fight against settler colonialism in Canada. And so is that something that you've seen through your work in Parliament and maybe with activist groups and activists on their own that you've communicated with, and that there is a little bit more of a public understanding and reckoning with the fact that these are global systems? It's not, you know, just in Palestine or just in Canada.
I definitely think so. I think that understanding is coming across and folks have been moving along, even the politicians, but unfortunately it's too late. Like you have people now calling for a ceasefire. It's too late for that to be effective. But I did a class talk this morning with a bunch of grade 4 and 5 year olds and they were on top of it. They brought me this watermelon keychain that I'm holding up that they made. It was like an entire classroom and the teacher had to cook me in the back. And it was just a regular elementary school in my riding that I didn't expect for hard-hitting issues to come up in at all. The folks are paying attention. They're talking about it at home, in their communities. So I have hope that at least for the next generation, things could get better. But a part of me is jaded. And thinking that the political class are coming along, they are being pushed, but I think everybody's realizing this is a genocide, even though it's too late. So I'm jaded to say that it's because of the narrative changing versus like it's a bit of political calculus at this point on their end. But overall, yeah, things are changing, and the younger generations make me feel a bit more hopeful.
Yeah, I really feel that hope too. You know, I kind of was like a wrap up question. I saw your segment on power and politics, and something that really struck me was people asking if you're sorry about what you said, and like, are you going to apologize? Are you going to retract your statement? And just kind of not understanding why you keep saying no. And so I was wondering, you know, for whether it be like listeners or for anybody else who wants to do an interview and ask you, do you apologize? You know, can you why it's important that we really do not apologize. Like, this is not something to be apologizing for.
No, absolutely not. I called for a ceasefire, and I quoted the United Nations. Again, it was the most watered down thing I could have said, that also wasn't just the blatant Israel has a right to defend itself that every other elected official was saying. And with upwards of more than 30,000 people being killed, like by the time that we're recording this, it's a ridiculous question, because had we actually called for a ceasefire at that time, maybe more people would be alive. And I don't even know that for sure, but to presuppose that I should be sorry about a very general, basic, watered-down statement that I'm not even proud of, it could have been... It's a frustrating question. I'm not going to apologize. And also, in the context of, like, what Ford is asking me to apologize for, he said that I supported the raping and murdering of Israeli women and children and babies getting their head cut off, or something ridiculous that had nothing to do with this statement calling for ceasefire. So yeah, there's so many reasons to never, ever, ever apologize, and I'm not going to. And like I said in the Power and Politics interview, history will absolve me, but also everybody who's been standing up and everybody who has lost their jobs. And it's our job to keep pushing against this idea that talking about Palestine and Palestinian liberation, a free Palestine, and imagining what that could look like and should look like, is scary and dangerous. It's not. It's the right thing to do, and it's the common sense thing to do. So I'm not apologizing. I'll sit as the centered member.
Good. I'm happy to hear that. I know everybody else would be very happy to know as well that you're going to keep doing what you're doing, keep being yourself, and keep fighting that fight.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate the chance to sit down and talk with you.
That was Madison Edward Wright and Sarah Jama in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Sarah and Madison. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Today is International Women's Day. Last weekend saw the annual International Women's Day March in Toronto. This year's march was dedicated to the women of Palestine who continue to suffer attacks by the Israeli military in Gaza. Since the October 7th attack by Hamas against Israel, the Israeli military has been bombing and attacking Gaza, which has resulted in the deaths of over 30,000 civilians, mostly women and children. Tamara Abu Abed of the Palestinian Youth Movement condemned the war in Gaza and stated, quote, "We reject any feminism that is not anti-imperialist," end quote. Staying with International Women's Day, Rabble has some great reading recommendations featuring talented women authors. Rabble's recommendations include River Mumma by Toronto author Zalika Reed Benta. River Mumma explores what it means to be Jamaican-Canadian while delving into Jamaican folklore. Another non-fiction book Rabble would like to highlight is Black Women Under State: Surveillance, Poverty, and the Violence of Social Assistance by Idil Abdillahi. In her book, Abdillahi explores the connection between social systems in Ontario and the carceral state, and how this connection has been used to reinforce systems of violence. Find our full list of books for International Women's Month on Rabble.ca. Also in feminist news, join us for Off the Hill this month as we focus on the national and global struggles of women and gender diverse people. These struggles include the gender wage gap, war raging on in Gaza and Ukraine, increased femicide, the attack on reproductive health, the likelihood of a Trump presidency, calls for justice for missing, murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people, misleading and dangerous narratives about trans people from elected officials, and more. This month, join social entrepreneur PK Much, Rabble columnist Charlotte Dalwood, and Professor Nadia Abu Zara in discussion and analysis, co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. Join us on March 20th, 2024 at 4:30 p.m. Pacific, 7:30 p.m. Eastern, with the registration link on rabble.ca. In labor news, unions continue to call for Canada to resume funding to the United Nations Relief Works Agency, UNRWA. UNRWA is the main agency providing relief and support to the people of Gaza. Canada suspended aid to UNRWA after it was accused by Israel of supporting Hamas's terrorist attack on October 7th, something UNRWA denies. Unions calling for the funding to be restored to UNRWA include the National Union of Public and General Employees, the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, the National Public Service Alliance of Canada, the Canadian Union of Public Employees, Unifor, and United Steelworkers. In national news, Rabble remembers the controversial and often destructive legacy of former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. Mulroney died last Friday at the age of 84. Rabble founder and columnist Judy Rebick argues that despite Mulroney's opposition to apartheid South Africa and acid rain, he did more harm than good. Mulroney's government attempted to criminalize abortion twice during his time as prime minister in the 1980s and 90s. His free trade policies weakened Canadian unions and made the Canadian economy more dependent on the United States. Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg pointed out that Mulroney was also a prolific privatizer, privatizing Canadian Crown corporations like Air Canada and the Canadian Development Corporation, which led to less innovation and government oversight. Staying in national news, last Monday saw the beginning of rolling blockades across the country against arms manufacturers who are sending their weapons to Israel. Israel continues its attack on the people of Gaza, with an estimated 30,000 civilians killed since October of last year. The blockades began last Monday morning in Scarborough, Ontario, as hundreds of protesters blocked the morning shift from starting at TTM Technologies, an American-based company. TTM Technologies builds circuit boards used in bombs and warplanes in Israel. The blockade was organized by World Beyond War and their allies, which includes members of the labor movement through organizations like Labor for Palestine. Rachel Small of World Beyond War promised that the blockades would continue at other arms manufacturers across the country until the government instituted an arms embargo on Israel. And finally, David Suzuki discusses how modern philosophies around economic growth are unsustainable. Both politicians and corporate executives believe that growth should have no caps or limits. But Suzuki reminds us that the world is finite and cannot sustain exponential growth. Suzuki argues that we need to reevaluate how we measure progress for the sake of all of our futures. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.